The Athletic.
The only way to score is, of course, to play with a hand break off.
Hello, I'm Ian Stone. This is Handbreak Off, the Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic. I'm joined this week by Amy Lawrence and Adrian Clark. Hello, guys.
Hello. Hello.
Afternoon. Now, since we last did a podcast, we played last Wednesday night a splendid back-to-the-wall 1-0 away win at Stamford Bridge, and we got in Chelsea's head so much that they lost the cup final and may well blow their season completely in the next couple of weeks. Now, next week we'll be doing a season review, and I promise you we'll keep it light. But in the meantime, we thought we'd talk about the fact that it has been 15 years since we left Highbury, and how is it working out? I think some of you may already know the answer to that. So before we get into the details, what do you miss most about Highbury? Adrian, we were talking about the last game, 2006, 7th of May against Wigan. You weren't there. No. And because you were saying you weren't invited, and even if you were invited, you probably would have blown it out for something more important anyway.
You're holding it against me still for the Dennis Bergkamp christening snub. Yeah, I like it.
Not just me, just the listeners.
I would love to have been there, and I do remember kind of watching the scenes on TV and feeling really jealous, actually, and envious of the people that were there, no doubt about it. Yeah, no, I wasn't invited, but I probably couldn't have got a ticket. I wasn't working for the club at that point, and I think I was sort of in the process of retiring around that time. But yeah, no, it was emotional scenes, but yeah, it was what a place. Absolutely loved it.
And what do you miss? What do you miss about the place?
I miss the entrance. I absolutely miss the entrance to the ground with the commissionaires, those steps. Used to loiter around those steps as a youth team player, as a young pro, and just see everyone milling up and down, you know, the road there. It was glorious. And then obviously inside with the marble halls and just the little nooks and crannies. I loved the tunnel, how skinny it was. I loved the halfway house where the players who weren't playing would go and have a cup of tea and gather before the games. It's those little nuances of Highbury that I miss the most. The Emirates just doesn't have that kind of character.
Amy, what about you? What do you miss the most about Highbury? Try and keep this to half an hour.
Yeah, I was about to say, apart from absolutely everything in its entirety, I think, like a lot of the best things in life, the anticipation of it is such a big part. And the journeys to Highbury is something that I miss a lot. And in the course of my football watching time there, I had different approaches according to where I lived at the time. I used to, first of all, come to Finsbury Park, get off the bus and walk up St. Thomas's Road that way. And as you're getting closer and closer and the throng starts to fill the streets, it was always that exhilaration. But I think probably my favourite was the turning down into Avenel Road from the top, Obert Park. Oh my God. I my mind's eye, that's the greatest scene and view.
The bobbing heads,
anywhere on the planet. I mean, yeah, and just that kind of the swell of crowd just sort of hanging around outside the marble halls and, you know, going between the sort of gunner's shop at the top and down towards the North Bank entrance or into the East Stand. And it was, you know, the commissionaires there by the door, that little touch. And at certain match days, you'd have, you know, be aware of the players. You knew that they were just the other side of those windows. You know, they could hear the crowd outside. It's not like the Emirates where it feels very much hermetically sealed and, you know, in through a car park, through a sort of tunnel and underground and in they go to the stadium, that there was that feeling of a more sort of visceral, direct connection, I think, in those days. So just bobbing around outside the ground really was, you know, waiting for the match to kick off, bumping into a few mates, had a certain magic that I think has been very difficult to replicate. I always remember Arsene Wenger saying how when he very, very first came to Highbury, for a match in 1989 when he was Monaco manager, he was just passing through London on like an overnight stay, famously the night that he met David Dean, and you know the story started really there. But he jumped in a cab from the airport and, you know, he'd been got a ticket to this match at Highbury. Obviously, being Arsene Wenger, if he had any time anywhere, the only thing he wanted to do was go and watch a football match. And the cab stops in the, you know, in the residential streets around Highbury. And I remember him telling the story and saying, I turned round to the driver and said, bud, where's the stadium? And the guy was like, well, it's here, mate, you know. And he'd never really seen anything like it, that whole sense of the ground. And I say that word on purpose, not the stadium, but the ground. There's a difference. Being right in the middle of, you know, just rows of local houses in the neighbourhood, it was and still is a really special thing.
Yeah. I mean, I can only agree with both of you, really. I didn't see all the nooks and crannies, Adrian. I did do the stadium tour, but I don't think I saw them all. But certainly I miss those. And the sort of singularity of Highbury, really, the uniqueness of the place. Certainly, Amy, what you're talking about coming round Avenel Road as you're coming down the hill and you see the ground, that's pretty special. I also miss going into the North Bank and having to climb some steps, and then you're in the North Bank and all that sea of people. And one more thing is night games. I mean, I think night games are very evocative anyway. I genuinely feel that. But night games at Highbury, I remember going to a League Cup quarter final against Liverpool in about late 70s, early 80s. I can't remember. There were 57,000 people in the ground. And it was thrilling. The noise was immense. It was really one of the most intense things I've ever experienced. You can subscribe to The Athletic UK right now for a special price of £3.99 for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/ArsenalPod to take advantage of this special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/ArsenalPod. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review.
We were a bit with the handbrake at the time.
I do realise, by the way, that there will be listeners who are below a certain age who never experienced any of this and would have experienced some of this stuff at the Emirates as well, because it isn't all gone. But we are talking about Highbury because it is just over 15 years, as I said, 7th of May 2006, when we left for the last time. And we wanted to talk in a bit more detail about why we left and whether it was a good idea. So, Amy, I'll start with you. Why did we leave Highbury?
I think we left Highbury because there was an awareness at board level that the way the game was changing, what they envisaged coming around the corner, although nobody envisaged quite the extent of the wave of money that was the tsunami, really, that was coming around the corner. But the sense that football was right in the middle of a period of change and modernisation and globalisation.
Amy, can I just they would have been having this conversation in the early to mid 90s, right? When the Premier League started and they'd have been looking ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there were some brief discussions about whether it was possible to expand Highbury, because, you know, for a long time the ground was plenty big enough. And yes, there were some, you know, 50,000 odd crowds every now and again over the previous decades. But in general, even title winning sides, you know, in 89 and stuff, it wasn't always packed to the rafters. So I think that it was a sense of, particularly when Arsene came and things were changing in terms of having a broader horizon out there and looking at where football was going. Star players, more money, TV, an international fan base, a much bigger sense of the club's position in Europe. All these things were changing really, really quickly. And they tasted that absolute elite top of the mountain ecstasy, really, of being one of the all-time great teams and feeling important in the football world, not just within England. And how is that sustainable? How can Arsenal grow? And they knew they couldn't grow that as much as they felt to keep up with demand at Highbury. Personally, because I'm a sort of a sad old nostalgist, I would have thought, sod that, I'll stay anyway because I love it too much. But, you know, that's why I would be crap at business.
Well, you might have actually made the right choice, to be honest.
Well, who knows? Well,
hindsight's a very easy thing, of course.
Exactly. But, you know, and for those of us lucky enough to have experienced it a lot and it was part of our lives, you know, that money can't buy how that felt. And the subsequent years, not just in terms of on the pitch, but as an experience. And that was our soul. That was our ancestral home. That was our place. That was our temple. It's been irreplaceable in terms of soul, in my opinion. But they had to move with the times. You have Thierry Henry, you have Dennis Bergkamp, you have Patrick Vieira, you have genuinely some of the best players in the world in front of your eyes playing for you. Now, how can you sustain that? There was such a limitation on the amount of finance that could be generated at Highbury. They didn't have much hospitality. They couldn't make a load of money from boxes, a bit, but not much. The gate receipts were limited because they couldn't really build anywhere. They thought about the corners, but the groundsman went, "Are you kidding me? The pitch will fall apart with no air circulating." They couldn't go up any higher because the local residents of those streets that we've just been talking about were like, "No way, we won't ever be able to see any sunlight. We'll be dwarfed by these big stands. You can't go above a certain height." They couldn't build very easily to expand where they were. So the next thing was, well, what can we do? And they began the process that ended up rather fortuitously very locally at the Emirates, because it was very nearly a much further and probably more grim story.
I mean, all right, listen, as far as the being able to build half a mile away was absolutely excellent. One of the things I loved about that last game of the season, sorry, that last game ever at Highbury in 2006, was that we went up the back of the stand after the game. And we're watching Roger Daltrey do his Highbury High song and various other bits and pieces. And we turned round and there's the new stadium all built and ready for us, Adrian. I mean, it seemed at the time like a dream move. Putting aside the nostalgia of your spiritual home, there's a brand spanking new stadium not half a mile away in the borough.
And it was a beautiful stadium. It's a beautiful looking stadium. And it was special at the time. And it gave Arsenal, at the time when television money wasn't quite at the level as it is now, it gave them the chance to sort of bring in as much revenue as a Manchester United, or, you know, almost as much money as them. And that was part of the thinking as well at the time. And because we had such good teams, such strong teams, it felt only right, really, that 60,000 Arsenal fans, whether they were local or whether they came from all over the world, got to see these great players, these great Arsenal teams in the flesh rather than the 38,000, because it was pretty hard to get a ticket. You know, once I'd left the club, it was not easy. It was not easy getting a ticket back to the games, you know. So it felt like the right move. But as Amy says, I completely concur with everything she said. The soul, you cannot replicate the soul of Highbury, well, unfortunately. But that would be the same everywhere. But
that's fair enough. Go on.
But if we are to create happy memories at Emirates Stadium, i.e. title-winning triumphs, then you created, you know, your own soul at Emirates, don't you? But we feel a little bit far off of that.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I think we can agree, and we'll do the season review next week just to see how far we are from reclaiming the soul of the club. But surely, if the pandemic has taught us one thing, Amy, that the soul of the club is everything. You know, the stuff with the ESL the other week, you can see the connection the fans have with the club. That, you can't lose that. And Arsene Wenger understands that better than anyone, and yet he still went for it, didn't he?
Well, he went for it because he looked at the finances and thought, how do you compete with... Originally, it was Roman Abramovich and Chelsea that was providing the biggest threat. And, you know, David Dean's famous comment about them appearing, firing £50 notes across the lawn, you know, was the sentiment of the era, which was like... And what was interesting as well is that the moment that they made their grand plan to leave Highbury for the Emirates and this much more lucrative future. I mean, the idea of making £1 million per match day, which I think was the figure that was flying around at the time when they first moved in, was a staggering increase on what was available at Highbury. It was just too tempting to do that, to try and compete, not just with Chelsea or you know, Man United obviously still were hugely important around that time, but also, you know, Arsenal were looking at the top European clubs and wanting to compete with the Barcelona, Juventus, AC Milan, Real Madrid group of that time as well. So in order to do so, they just knew they needed more. But of course, the biggest irony is that the plan was based on what I would call a pre-Abramovich world. And the plan should have worked. If football hadn't suddenly
TV money.
Been impacted so enormously by this extreme finance of oligarchs and nation states and what have you. And, never mind the TV money, but actual, you know, benefactors, personal benefactors who were able to, you know, fund a £200 million transfer window just like that, just with a click of her fingers for doing nothing, before anybody had even imagined FFP or how to try and balance things at all. It changed very radically, very quickly. But Arsenal's plans made prior to that should have made Arsenal one of the richest clubs around. Yeah. They should have had a massive advantage because they were the first ones, or amongst the first, to build one of these sort of mega stadia that would generate so much money to enable them to be self-sustaining, not in a cheap way, but self-sustaining in a lavish way. They knew they were going to have to kind of tighten the belt for a while, but the idea was you come out the end of that little period and right, okay, you're ready to absolutely challenge for everything and against anybody. But the landscape changed.
Completely.
How
I mean,
they to
well,
know?
That's true. As I said, hindsight is a wonderful thing. I mean, Adrian, the TV money. I mean, the team that finishes bottom of the Premier League gets £100 million in prize money, which is more than Arsenal would take in gate receipts through the season.
Yeah, everything changed. Amy's right. We can no longer compete for the best players around, wages-wise, because of Roman Abramovich and what he was able to offer teams. And also the influx of money, not just for our immediate rivals, but across the board. The rise in revenues through TV allowed everybody to strengthen and become, you know, improve their own resources. And not least in scouting departments, for example. You know, Arsenal were always a leading light. They were one step ahead, weren't they? For all those years, we used to spot the very best talent overseas and bring them in, you know. And
Arsene Wenger was one step ahead. He used to watch four games a day on TV and he knew what was going on in the Belgian second division. So that's what happened
exactly.
There.
Exactly, but yeah, but 15 years later, everybody had huge recruitment teams that, you know, European networks of scouts. All of a sudden, that advantage was lost as well because everybody was richer. Everybody could compete to a certain level on and off the pitch.
So would we have been better off staying at Highbury, Amy? I mean, in the end, if we'd have spent that money, the £300-400 million, whatever we spent on the stadium on the pitch, we'd surely be in a better position now, wouldn't we?
Look, it's 15 years. It's very, very hard to predict. And I think you can look at some teams who have exceeded all expectation and punched above their weight on not the highest resources. Obviously, Leicester winning the league, they didn't do it for nothing recently, but I mean, certainly weren't paying the biggest bucks going to build that team.
In a small stadium.
You know, you can be smart, you can achieve, and you can waste.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's been a fair amount of wastage at our place over the last few years, let's be honest. So I think it's down to something more than just where you play and how much sort of money you can generate on a match day. So God only knows, but I've put selfishly, I'd say I probably would have enjoyed 15 more years at Highbury. That's not very nice to the 22,000 who haven't been able to get, wouldn't have been able to get in. And remember, there was a huge season ticket waiting list in the latter years of Highbury. That 38,000, it was almost like a closed shop. You know, people who had season tickets sat on them. They were like gold dust. And there were some, it was in the hundreds of thousands on the waiting list. You know, I remember her speaking to mates. Yeah, I'm sure it is. But I remember, I'm 88,703 on the waiting list. And you think, God, Jesus, so you're going to live that long? I mean, you can see why they wanted to do it.
Well, Everton are doing that position at the moment, Stoney, aren't they? They're willing to sacrifice the soul of Goodison to move on to a brand new stadium. And they're choosing to do that in this
and
era.
I just look at them and think, oh, God, don't, please. And that's just me being an old fart. I realise that. It's not sensible. But I just think, oh, God, you don't know what you've got there, you know? I mean, obviously they do. And I can, you know, I'm sure they've got all the right reasons themselves that they've thought through. But it is... All those beautiful grounds, I just look at them and think, please, 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 like, protect them like works of art, you know?
Can I say, I've never been back.
To Highbury?
Since it got converted. Not converted to the flat. I've never been inside Highbury since it stopped being a football stadium. I went in there a couple of years ago.
I had a walk on the gate was open. I had a walk on the lawn, on the garden. And it brought back a lot of memories. And of course it did. But we left in 2006 and we tried... I mean, obviously, because of the fact that we had to finance the stadium, Arsene Wenger tried to do it with the youth, didn't he? He tried, you know, he brought in a lot of young players and it almost worked. Cesc Fabregas, of course, being probably the best of all of them. But, Amy, was he let down a little bit by some of the players leaving when maybe if they'd stuck around for a couple of years, things might have worked out? Yeah, I know. It's a ridiculous question. I don't know the answer. I'm just asking.
I don't know. It felt really close. I think when you think about kind of sliding doors moments and again, the master plan, there was so much logic in it. The master plan of moving to the bigger stadium and then in that interim period before, ideally speaking, you're going and getting all the best players in the world that you can get again, you try and build something cleverly with what became called Project Youth. It was a good plan, to try and fastidiously... handpick the best talent as young as possible, as gettable as possible, and bring them in so that they could be imbued with that sense of Arsenal spirit and caring about the club so they would want to stick around. It really nearly worked when you think back to 2008. That team could have won the league, and that could be a changer. But obviously you mentioned Cesc, but you know, people like Carlos Vela, you know, when they got him and Danielson, who ended up being not quite good enough, whereas Van Persie obviously was, and Szczesny was a great young player, and Ramsey, and they did have tremendous success with some of the youngsters that came in. But Vela and Danielson, for example, were amongst the most coveted players and senderos in global football. They were guys who were prime, coveted players who were, you know, voted best in the world at like Youth World Cups and things like that. And it was an absolute feather in the cap that Arsenal got them. And they had this reputation of like, look, if Arsenal want you when you're 16, you know, you could be onto something here.
It did nearly work. I mean, Adrian, is that our way out today, Project Youth, do you think? I mean, listen, it's not like we can pay the big bucks. We can't be spending, you know, I mean, obviously Harry Kane, even if he did leave Tottenham, he wouldn't come to Arsenal anyway. We should wait 3 years and get him on a free, really. That'd be the way to do it properly. But reveal him from behind a curtain. But Project Youth is the way to go today, isn't it?
Oh, it feels like we're heading that way, doesn't it? Yeah, because they've definitely got a bit of Arsenal in their blood, haven't they, these young players?
Yes.
They've got that old-fashioned drive and you can feel it matters to them. And they've made a brilliant difference in the second half of this season, the younger guys. So, yeah, it could be. It's not just that. That alone won't bring you success. You know, you have to have that joined-up thinking from top to bottom of the club. Clear strategies, great recruitment. You have to foster a special team spirit, you know, all of these things. It's fresh in the mind because of Leicester's success at the weekend at Wembley, because they have all of that, and with less resources than us, they've been incredibly successful. It's old fashioned values, I think, and it's as simple as that. Sometimes it is getting a bunch of hard working, talented players to really fight for the shirt with the right management structure around them that are all pushing in the same direction. That's the formula.
We saw it at Wembley, but also that requires joined up thinking from the top to the bottom of the club, Amy. I mean, one can't ever imagine a time when Stan Kroenke will come on the pitch and lift the cup with the players, even if we win it. We're not Leicester. We can't do it like them. And it might not work in the same way at our club.
But we could aspire to, like Adrian says, to tick a lot of those boxes. Why the hell not?
Because do you think Arsenal plan?
Why not recruit more wisely? Mm-hmm. That's been the heart of their success.
Can I answer that question? I remember Arsene Wenger talking about this and the fact that he would have to spend 30 or 40 million pounds on a player because Arsenal fans would not accept a player like, say, Riyad Mahrez coming from the French 8th Division or N'Golo Kante.
Oh,
well, boom. That's what he said.
Oh,
that's what he
on.
Said, Amy. We're talking about it now. And Arsenal fans, I think at this point, Arsenal fans might accept that, right? If we got Riyad Mahrez or N'Golo Kante. But Arsenal fans have expectations of
but
themselves.
But what's the difference? I'm sorry. Do you not think that Arsene felt that Arsenal fans didn't accept Koscielny? Who came from the second division in France?
I think that was later on. I think that was later on. I think there was certainly a period, and I've heard him say this when he talked about the fact that it wouldn't be acceptable for us with the fans to spend 500,000 or £1 million on a player when we should be spending 20.
What about Kolo Touré?
You're
going to
name loads of players now. I know you are, right?
Well, this doesn't ring true.
No, I mean, if you don't remember him
saying
that?
Are we not getting skewed here? Is it not a case of stripping it back a little bit and saying, look, at the moment, we can't afford to compete with a City, a United, a Chelsea financially for the most gifted footballers, beautiful footballers on the planet. We can't. But what we can do is build a team, build a collective where square pegs in square holes, round pegs in round holes, whereby the most you do the basics better than everybody else, and then from there that is when you can then build and bring in the flair, the talent to take you over the line. If you've got goal scorers and that ethic through the team, then you can upset the odds, and unfortunately that's where Arsenal are at the moment. We are an underdog, and perhaps that's the biggest challenge for Arsenal at the moment. We have to accept our position in the order of things right now and maybe adjust our style accordingly. I don't know. It's just a thought.
Adrian, you're the voice of reason.
Am I? I don't know.
Certainly in this company.
We were a bit with the handbrake at time.
This is the Arsenal podcast, Handbrake Off, brought to you by The Athletic. Ian Stone here with Amy Lawrence and Adrian Clark. Now, there was a video, actually, from TIFO. It's a podcast. They do regular podcasts for The Athletic. And they explained Mikel Arteta's tactics. Adrian, I watched this twice. I'm getting better at it, but even still, a lot of this stuff, it sort of goes above the heads. I'm not saying it might just be me. Maybe you guys are going, you're just stroking your chins going, well, yes, that's what the donut against the flat back four or whatever.
For once, I'm in your camp here, Stoney. It's a rare thing.
Well, no, I hate tactics. Not into it at all. I'm joking.
It was very nice. It was very good what he did, explain some of the tactics and. But there was one moment when he mentioned about Mikel Arteta overthinking. I think it was against Fulham and the way that they were lined up with a low block, I think, which has suddenly become a thing. I mean, does he overthink? Do you think in your considered opinion?
Yeah, first of all, it was a really good video. I enjoyed it from Jay. I do like JJ Boyd.
Yes.
He's a good lad. And he came across well. And it took you through the journey of various formations and ideas that Arteta has had. And it does And the fact that there were so many different incarnations of a shape shows you that maybe he has overthought things, because he hasn't been in the job that long and he's tried an awful lot of different methods, really. My one big criticism of him would be in part that he overthinks, but mainly the overriding theme, I think, is that our play under him has become programmable. It's like pre-programmed. It's sort of like when you're here, we move the ball there, and X player and Y player move into these positions. And I just feel that opposition teams see us coming now because we're less spontaneous than we used to be. What I think we're doing too much of is playing in front of the opposition. And you know, we're creating some nice patterns. I can see absolute logic to creating these overloads and having this guy spare over here. But ultimately, not enough of our tactical approach, in my view, is actually hurting the opposition. And that is the next phase of the journey, I would imagine, to be much more penetrative. And you know what? It kind of comes back to what I was saying in the previous segment. It comes down to runners and players wanting to push themselves into positions where defenders don't want them to be or don't expect them to be. We're just a bit too predictable, I guess, is the sort of encapsulation of Arteta so far.
Well, in that case, then, maybe, Adrian, that first bit of the video when he's talking about how it was against Fulham, and he was talking about getting overloads, but he was saying that it was a problem because Kieran Tierney wasn't fit. Can you explain a little bit about what the thinking was?
Well, no, I just think, yeah, he anticipated that Fulham would have, you know, be very narrow and protect the central spine, which is what most teams in Fulham's position would do, and therefore they would overload the wide areas. But the problem was that it left a void in the middle, because the person that was overloading was Emile Smith Rowe. Now, Emile Smith Rowe at number 10 was either going to the left or going to the right to create those 3-versus-2s. And when you've got two central midfielders that don't score goals or don't break into the box, when that ball comes into the area from the wing, you've got one centre forward and the opposite forward maybe at the far post. And that's not enough. And that, I think, is as sort of simplistic as I can explain it. And for me, it's, yeah, ideally, yeah, if the number 10 goes wide to create an overload, that's good. That's a good tactic. But what you have to do then is encourage, I don't know, in this case, would it have been Danny Ceballos or whoever the other central midfielder was, to just do an Aaron Ramsey and get into the box. That is what we don't do enough of under Mikel Arteta.
One of our great goal-scoring midfielders to maybe make a run into the box.
Exactly. We're way too light inside the box. So look, there's a lot of what Mikel Arteta does that makes absolute sense on the chalkboards and when you think about the opposition weaknesses. But in reality, you need to get more players between the width of the goalposts inside the box. And I think to do that, we have to create, yeah, there's a lot of things, but more partnerships, more slick combinations, and certainly more play down the centre of the field, because it's great going wide, but unless when the ball comes back in the box, players are there, we aren't going to score enough goals.
Amy?
Yeah, and that great goal-scoring midfield sort of run scenario is taking place about 300 miles north, right?
Doesn't realise we're talking about Joe Willock, who's doing a marvellous job up in Newcastle and scoring goals week by week.
Adrian, just on the sort of tactical, technical front, I wonder if you could solve a mystery for me.
I don't know. Yeah, go on.
What is the difference between what is currently called a low block and what in old money used to be just called sort of sitting deep?
There's no difference. There's really no difference. Okay, it's exactly the same.
Just checking.
There's no difference. It's just squishing the space between the midfield and the defence, where your Ozils, Smith Rowe's want to be. That's what teams do against us. Do you know one thing that Mikel hasn't tried and what JJ in that video didn't get the opportunity to talk about? And that was two up front. 3-5-2, 4-4-2. I don't really mind what system we play, to be honest, because I think they all kind of blend into one event, you know, ultimately. But I just I just feel that we've been too light up front. And what we're not seeing is those combinations. Remember when Giroud was here, even though he was a one up front kind of guy, those bouncing the balls into the centre forward, cut back to the on-rushing midfielder, forward to the on-rushing winger. We saw a lot of that. And I feel that that's gone out of our game. And for me, just sometimes trying a front two with, you know, Martinelli and Lacazette, or, you know, you could try Oba and Lacazette, but just two front men just to link up, create angles. Because that, what that does, guys, if you have two strikers up against two central defenders or even three, and one comes short and one spins behind, it just causes indecision and it brings the odd player out of position to create space for someone else to run into. And that is where I think we're falling down, because one striker is not taking defenders away well enough, and we've not got those runners from deep that are surging into those spaces. That for me is the missing ingredient for us. I'm desperate for Mikel Arteta to sort of recognise it and maybe just try something to improve us in that department.
Do you think this overthinking thing that we're talking about, do you think it's partly a factor? I'm asking you this, Adrian. Do you think it's partly a factor of him having worked so closely with Pep Guardiola, obviously one of the best coaches in the world, and someone who has some of the best players at his disposal as well? And so they can be a lot more flexible in their tactics, whereas, again, going back to that phrase we used earlier, we maybe have to cut our cloth accordingly.
Yeah, it's quite advanced, isn't it? Some of the sort of ploys and strategies that he uses are quite advanced, and they do cause problems for teams. They really do. But I guess so. And also, I think it's also in part because he realised as soon as he walked through the door that Arsenal's players aren't as good as Man City's players, and that he also realised that defensively, let's be honest, we're a little bit dodgy. And that a lot of what he's done and implemented has actually been to stabilise us as a team when we don't have the ball. And it's definitely sort of impacted on our flow and fluency going forward. I think until he has full trust in the defensive guys, I think there's that reluctance to be too bold or to concentrate too much on the attacking side.
Well, while we're on the subject of defence, there's been a couple of pieces that have been written, which we'll quickly talk about. One by James about David Luiz having been one of Mikel Arteta's trusted lieutenants, but basically asking whether it's time for a rebuild. There's also in the piece, they talk about the fact that Xhaka, it's sort of understood that he might leave, and we still haven't sorted out Lacazette's contract issues. David Luiz, it sort of works sometimes, didn't it?
Yeah. I think in hindsight, when we look back on it all, it was a transfer born out of sudden necessity. I think had Laurent Koscielny not suddenly felt he needed to leave, which happened very late in that window, I'm not convinced that it was necessarily a deal that would have happened when it happened, to bring in David Luiz. So it was one of those moments where everything sort of fell into place. There was an urgent need to find very quickly an experienced centre-back to replace the influence of Koscielny, who was the captain, remember. So given the connections between certain people involved in recruitment at Arsenal at the time and Kier Jurabjian's representatives, it was an easy fix. But I think that just going back to what Adrian said before about this kind of blueprint for how Arsenal might try and be competitive in this current environment, and, you know, trying to find a core with very smart recruitment of younger, hungrier, up and coming players who can, who can maybe not be fully formed, warts and all, let's just say, and qualities and all, but who's got some maturing to do, but got so much to give and so much to learn and offer. You only have to look at talking about Leicester, Fofana coming into their defence.
19.
It's not impossible if you get the right choices, the right personalities and the right qualities in a player who comes in, it can blossom very, very quickly. And I think it is the right time for Arsenal to try. There's been some talk of this. I mean, it's a bit conflicting messages. There's talk of, you know, the rebuild 1 week, and then all of a sudden in the press conference earlier today seemed to be more of a like. I saw a comment saying everybody who's under contract will be here. And I mean, unless I misunderstood that slightly, that's not quite the same message.
That's not what we expected.
I think it would make more sense to be a bit clearer strategically exactly what Arsenal are trying to do. But, you know, I think that moving on from the sort of Xhaka, Luiz and obviously Mustafi Ozil, guys who have already gone, but that sort of generation where for all the abilities that they had, there was an underlying sense of doubt that would creep in at times. And it feels like a freshness needs to be there.
Well, one of the people who may come in is William Saliba. There's a piece in The Athletic, Art de Rocher and Luke Bosher talked about the fact that he's coming to Arsenal at the end of the season. Mikel Arteta has said this. I mean, he could be the Wesley Fofana for us, couldn't he, Adrian?
Could be. Yeah, hope he is. I really do. I think he's comfortable on the ball. Look, with David Luiz, it was a really awkward one. It's the right decision, I think, ultimately, even though he's probably been our most reliable defender during the pandemic. I think his distribution has been brilliant.
Best
for
passer,
us. And he's put in some colossal individual performances. So it's a shame in that respect, but he's ultimately holding us back by being there and certainly holding back a player like Saliba. So, yeah, look, it is time. It is time to give guys like him an opportunity. I think I actually feel that we could be or should maybe be in the market for a lot of other defenders as well, younger, hungrier defenders, definitely a right back and probably another centre half as well. Moving forward, and obviously a deputy left back. So yeah, I'm hoping for a lot of defensive changes within the squad this season. But Saliba is the one we're all eager to see. And yeah, if Fofana can do it, you know, judging by their reputations in France, then Saliba can do it.
So a left back, a right back and some centre backs. But other than that, we're covered, essentially, is what you're saying. One of the players who did play with distinction at centre back for us and plenty of other positions as well is a random ask generator this week has come up with Kolo Touré. Amy, give us a memory of Kolo Touré.
Ah, oh, Kolo.
It's lovely. That's exactly how a lot of people would speak about him.
The iconic story of his trial is just always worth a retell. And you know, so the story goes, he turned up from the Ivory Coast, and I think he had a week on trial or something, and there was a practice match at the training ground, and pretty much by the sounds of it, one by one, he took out some of the most important people at Arsenal Football Club. I believe Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp, another top player. And then most famously of all, pretty much with the ball going out of play along the side, slide tackled straight into Arsene and caused him a bit of an injury. And I think Arsene had some ice on his ankle or something after the training session. And Kolo was inconsolable in tears in the dressing room, like, what have I done? What have I done? And Ray Parlour said that he went to see the boss and said, are you all right? And he said, oh, the boy's really upset in there. And Arsene said, I like him. I like his enthusiasm. We sign him tomorrow. Which is a great tale.
It's brilliant. Adrian, Kolo Touré.
I think his partnership with Sol Campbell is what stands out. Not any specific games that come to mind, but I remember seeing him on a visit to Highbury when I wasn't working. He was playing at right back, and I just remember seeing just his power and sort of enthusiasm. He's just bouncing up and down the wing, and I thought, wow, I quite like the look of this kid. And then the partnership he formed with Sol Campbell was just immense. They were two brutes, really, weren't they? And I'd known Sol since we were kids. So to see him in the Arsenal team was was a treat anyway. But then to see this, he was a warrior, really, wasn't he, Kolo Touré? Didn't have the sort of great height or particular skill. He always looked a little bit uncomfortable when the ball was at his feet, but he just loved defending and he loved stopping strikers. And I just, yeah, those two as a partnership were immense, and obviously history will judge them as one of our best partnerships as well, I guess.
Quite, I mean, an invincible, you know. I mean, he just, because I remember seeing him when he first played, and he looked a little headless chicken, I think, Kolo Touré. Yeah. You know, when he was running about in midfield, and you thought he could take out one of our own players, he could take out one of theirs, who knows? But as a defender, especially with experienced players next to him, you know, and a goalkeeper behind him who wasn't going to take no nonsense from anyone, he really blossomed, I think. And he was a huge-hearted player. I mean, he was part of that defence that that didn't let in a goal for 10 games in the Champions League, wasn't he? And, you know, an immense defender, really. I was very sad when he left us, but I think that's my main memory of him, really, is him in midfield running about and thinking, no, Kolo, no, don't do that. But as a defender, what a player. You're right. What a player.
You used the right word, heart. I think he was a player with heart. And then that was when you looked at him, you thought, well, he's a wholehearted player, definitely. Not the most talented, but yeah, just loved football. And I think he was very, very, you know, excited and happy to be an Arsenal player. No doubt about that. That's shone through.
Amy?
Well, I'd say that he became a centre-back almost by accident. When you think about it, that was obviously where he established himself. But I think in his first year or something, he played, possibly cameoed in just about every outfield position except goal. You know, he didn't play in goal, but he cropped up just about everywhere else as a kind of classic utility player. I think Arsenal was just trying to find out what he was about and where he was going to be best used for. And in the pre-season, they had a friendly game and Arsene suddenly decided to try out Sol Campbell with Kolo in the centre of defence. And his mate was managing the other team. I can't remember exactly who it was now. But Arsene, is one of the things that he always said was that, you know, you feel the strength of an opponent when they play against you. So he would often judge opposition players quite well, and he used to quite like other people judging how it felt to play against his players. So he went up to his mate at the end of the game and said, "What did you think?" And this guy said, "Wow, your two centre backs, like, they've got some power. You know, that's really something." And it kind of cemented with an experiment in pre-season what went on to become the invincible centre half partnership.
Yeah. Adrian, any more before we move on?
I don't know. Just a personal one. It's probably since it's the Kolo Touré song, isn't it? The Yaya Touré Kolo Touré song that they do at the darts. I've been there. I've been at Ali Pali doing the Yaya Touré with my hands in the air, and I'm getting low doing the Kolo Touré. And I've even taught my children it. And a little funny aside, I was doing the Kolo Touré song with my little girl a couple of years ago, and I kind of fell over doing it and broke her bed. So Kolo Touré will always be imprinted on my mind for that rather unfortunate incident.
All right, well, we're talking about songs then. Let's have a song. Amy, should we have a song?
All right, I'm going to go back to my maudlin teenage phase.
Is it goth? Is this a goth classic?
It's not. It's probably a bit more new romantic, sort of post-new romantic than goth, but I love David Sylvian. And when he went solo, he did a song that's very beautiful called Nostalgia. I'm going to pick that because we've been talking about Highbury.
Okay. Adrian, what about you?
Yeah, the one I've picked is based on where we are really in the season rather than the sort of nostalgia of Highbury. So it doesn't really fit with what we talked about. But just thinking about that Chelsea win, like, it was a lion-hearted display against a really, you know, against a team that were desperate to beat us, and we held firm. But there was still that little bit of emptiness about it because it didn't matter. And I really hate where we are in this season right now, where nothing really matters. The last two games, there's nothing on it, and it leaves me feeling a bit uncomfortable, and I'm sort of itching for matches that matter again. So yeah, I picked out Going Through the Motions by Hot Chocolate. Because that's kind of what we're doing at the moment until this summer rebuild, until we kick off again next year where suddenly, you know, every point will matter again, which is, it can't come soon enough for me.
Well, you've cheered me up, to be honest with you, this talk of the rebuild. So I'll have Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles, all right? Because it's I feel sunshine over the horizon. That's it. That's Handbrake Off. We're going to do, I believe, a little review of the season next week. So woo! You can put that in your diary. Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Adrian. Lovely to see you. Thanks to Tayo, our producer as well. I've been Ian Stone. Thank you for listening. This has been Handbrake Off, the Arsenal podcast, brought to you by The Athletic. The Athletic.